Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour or so. It's a pleasure to have you with me. Thanks for spending some time. I've got a somewhat experimental show for you today because I'm going to be covering three related topics, which is not my usual round. Usually I go deep into one thing, but they're all joined by a common thread. So work with me here. I hope you find something enlightening and maybe, well, I hesitate to call this enjoyable because I've got some bad news for you. But maybe we can get through this together. Maybe there's some power in community as we survive this. Let me explain what I'm up to. The title of this show is Three Emerging Dystopias. And I'll tell you in a second which exactly are those three dystopias I have in mind. So let me back up. I guess the way to think about this is over the years, I've had a number of science fiction authors on the show. These are people who have written books about various dystopian scenarios, future worlds or future states of the country or human society that are dystopian in various ways, always very inventive and creative. And somewhere in the interview, I tend to ask them, how do you come up with the ideas specifically for this dystopia? And in some cases, these are authors who had come up with dystopian ideas that then came true. And I'm always impressed by that when someone can look into the future and say, be careful of this happening, and then 5 years later or 3 years later, it actually happens. And when I ask science fiction authors that question, they all seem to give the same answer, which is they say, I'm paraphrasing here, of course. They say essentially, I'm not a fortune teller. What you do if you want to understand or predict the dystopia that's coming is look around you today. Just look at what's happening in the world today and then extend that into the future. In other words, if you want to imagine a coming dystopia that may actually occur, I don't mean some wild, fantastical scenario that would never come to pass. I mean, if you want to imagine something that has some chance of becoming reality, here's how to predict that future. Look around you right today, just what's happening in the world today, and extend it as far as you can using today as a starting point, if that makes sense. And so in that vein, I wanted to share with you three emerging dystopias that I have been noticing recently, and I thought it might be interesting to go over all three of these with you and give some basis for why I'm seeing these. So these are the three emerging dystopias or crises, if you prefer that word. I know dystopia is maybe a little overused, especially on this show. So if you want, you can call this three emerging crises that I see taking shape today and may turn into full-blown crises / dystopias in coming years. So that's why the title of the show is Three Emerging Dystopias. And here they are. The first one is money. The second one is water. And the third one is truth. Now, of course, these are just headings for what I'm going to get into. But the three emerging dystopias are money, water, and truth. And what I'm going to try to do is spend, 15-ish minutes on each one of them. If I can get through the material, I have much more material than I can fit into an hour, as often happens on the show. But I'm going to try to spend about 15 minutes on each one. Let's see how I do. And this is important. You have a role here, too. If you are interested in checking up on what I'm saying and or reading further, diving down deeper into these topics, these articles, these sources, I want you to go to the playlist where I have put all of these links. The playlist is at tectonic.fm tectonic.fm, and find the episode called Three Emerging Dystopias and click the playlist link. It's right there, and as you will see, there are many links, many bullet points and many links to go through to describe each of these three. So why don't we get started with money? This is the first emerging dystopia that I wanted to talk to you about, and specifically money is the header. The specific topic that I'm describing here is something called surveillance pricing. I think I may have mentioned this once or twice in passing on past shows, but I haven't really gone very deep on it. The idea of surveillance pricing, let me just read an excerpt from something from The Cut from February 6, 2025. What if the retailer that sold you both of the items that you just bought had raised their prices slightly just for you based on your previous shopping habits? Because it had access to data that, for example, pigeonholed you as a stressed out parent who won't notice that you're being upcharged for medical supplies, especially at 5 a.m., or just because it could. This is known as surveillance pricing, and a recent study from the Federal Trade Commission suggests that it happens all the time. Okay, so that's just a brief example from The Cut. If you, let's say you're a stressed out parent, you need some medical supplies, you're shopping at 5 a.m., and if the surveillance dossier at the retailer's site or platform knows these things about you, it can slightly upcharge those items for you. It can slightly raise the prices, not enough that you would notice, but enough that they would get a few extra dollars out of you. This is how surveillance pricing works. Retailers, and not just retailers, banks, government agencies, everybody who is on the other side of the screen is building a surveillance dossier on you. And as I've said many times, the idea behind the surveillance dossier is not simply to be creepy, although it is creepy. It's to exert an asymmetry of power over you, to exert control over you, to have the power to manipulate you by using the information they have about you without your knowledge or consent in many cases. So if you're shopping at, just think of a retailer. If you're shopping online from a retailer, you could be getting upcharged based on what the retailer thinks is your capacity to pay more or your willingness to pay more because you're stressed, you're desperate, you have a few extra bucks, or for any reason they want to charge you more. Their surveillance AI algorithms have the capacity to do that. So there is a bill. This is from the markup in March 13, 2025. There's a bill in the California legislature to combat surveillance pricing. And the markup writes that Amazon, these are companies that have engaged, that means they've been documented as engaging in surveillance pricing, include Amazon, ride-sharing apps, that's to say Uber and Lyft, travel companies, and retail giants such as Staples and Target. Surveillance pricing can set different prices for customers based on factors including internet browsing data or where the customers live. In one recent example published by SFGate, a person in the Bay Area was offered a hotel room for $500 more than people in less affluent areas. So this is just one example of an AI surveillance algorithm seeing that someone is in the market for a hotel room and their home address is in some affluent zip code or on an affluent street. And it says, the algorithm says, well, I bet this person has the capacity to pay a lot more. Now, you might be looking at this and you could say, well, okay, we'll soak the rich. If all it's doing is making the rich people pay more, well, why is that our problem? Just soak the rich. That's the, you know, comeuppance or what have you. Well, I would say be careful about that sort of attitude, because this is just the mirror image of what surveillance algorithms do. Usually they start with the most vulnerable. And so these could be marginalized communities. There could be racial aspects to the surveillance and the manipulation, even the oppressive aspects of these surveillance algorithms. And there also, if people say, well, I'm not part of that marginalized group. Why should I care if other people are being oppressed? Once again, be careful. So whether we're saying the algorithms are targeting the rich or they're targeting marginalized communities, either way, this is not good. And the reason is the algorithms start with a group where they can gain a toehold, and they move from there to other groups. In other words, you're on the menu at some point. You're in there at some point. You will be marginalized, manipulated, oppressed, upcharged, whatever, choose your verb. You're going to be affected by this at some point. And that's why it's so important for us to have a legal defense in the form of legislation that will protect us as citizens, consumers, travelers, shoppers, whatever, against this asymmetry of power from this incredible concentration of power in just a few hands that are controlling these AI surveillance algorithms. So NBC News on July 23rd, 2025, wrote that Democratic Representative Greg Kassar is introducing legislation to ban surveillance pricing. And so there's a bill called the Stop AI Price Gouging and Wage Fixing Act of 2025, and that comes on the heels of the Federal Trade Commission study, and some states like California, as I just said, are seeking to ban surveillance pricing as well. Representative Kassar noted one company, I mentioned travel companies before, one company that is interested in integrating AI more into its pricing algorithms is Delta Airlines. This is from NBC News now. On an investor call this month, Delta Airlines president Glenn Hauenstein said the airline's goal is to have one-fifth, that is 20%, of all of its fares set by AI. And that'll be up from what it is now, just 3%. But the company disputed in a statement that prices would be set based on personal information. Oh, heavens no. Why would we ever do something like that? So what Delta Air, I just love these mealy-mouthed excuses from the corporation saying, we would never. How dare you, sir? So let me get this straight, Delta. You're going to be using AI to set personalized pricing, okay, customer by customer, but you're not going to be basing that on personal information? What in the world are you going to base it on then? Astrology? Of course. And maybe technically they are correct. I'm not suggesting that Delta Airlines is lying. That often the corporations will come up with a way that is legally truthful, but effectively, And even if it's truthful, this is really the point I'm driving at here. You always, when corporations say, we're not doing that, we are not doing that, you have to add the word yet. That's really important in these corporate excuses. We are not doing that yet. We are not using your personal information yet. Because if this gets normalized, if surveillance pricing gets normalized in whatever form they're using it now, of course they're going to be using personal information next, because other companies have already done so. And why wouldn't they? Why would they leave the money on the table? And so the last example I want to give for this emerging dystopia of money in the form of surveillance pricing is the example of Uber. Now, I mentioned ride-sharing companies before. I would guess that Lyft, which is Uber's main competitor, is doing this, but I don't have any documentation posted on the playlist. But I do have documentation about Uber. Uber is very deep into surveillance pricing and personalized pricing. And there is a new report out by a past guest of Tectonic. He was on the show a number of years ago, Columbia Business School professor named Len Sherman. And Len has written a new report. It came out June 23rd, 2025. It's called How Uber Became a Cash Generating Machine. Because you remember a few years ago, Uber was actually losing money. They're having to go to their war chest from all their venture capital to try to stay alive and try to expand. But their fortunes have changed in recent years. And Len is writing this report saying through exhaustive research into the numbers, the way only a business school professor can manage to do this, he has found what he thinks is the reason why Uber is making a lot more money, or as he says in the title, a cash-generating machine. And basically, it's surveillance pricing. I'm going to read you the conclusion, one of the conclusions of the report that's pertinent to what I'm talking about. Quote, Uber's financial success relies heavily on opaque algorithmic price discrimination on both sides of its marketplace, that is to say, deciding what customers are going to pay and deciding what the driver contractors are going to make on both sides of the marketplace, and relies heavily on deceptive business practices that boost profits at the expense of riders and drivers, often while delivering degraded service. So basically what Uber is doing here is it's using its AI surveillance algorithms and the data it has both on customers and on drivers, because it has a wealth of data on both sides, to, for customers, set the price as high as it possibly can that customers will barely be willing to pay, and for drivers to set their pay as low as possible, just barely enough to make it worth their while to go pick up the passengers. So both sides are ruthlessly being exploited, and it's causing a degraded service as a result. Now, you have to remember, kids, before we had Uber, we had, here in New York City anyway, we had the Taxi and Limousine Commission, and in cities and towns all over the world, there were regulated taxi commissions or taxi groups. They went under taxi companies, went under different names. But the basic idea was there would be posted rates for what a taxi ride would cost, you know, by the mile and by the half a mile at the end. And then maybe there's a charge to start the ride or whatever. It was usually posted on a rate card as soon as you got in, and there would be a meter. And so there was no discrimination based on whether someone was coming from an affluent area or maybe someone was getting a pickup in an area the driver didn't like. No, everyone had the same rate card. Now what's happening is Uber, which has broken the bonds of all regulation and all legislation and all common decency and ethics that, such as they were built into the regulation of taxi commissions, and now it's just a pure profit engine. It's pure exploitation based on surveillance. And I do want to give one more example here. This affects not just, you know, when you buy a plane ticket or when you reserve a hotel room or when you take an Uber ride, although I would recommend that you not use Uber if you can avoid it. It also affects people in much more high-risk situations. There was a fascinating report from the Roosevelt Institute, December 17, 2024, which was called Uber for Nursing: How an AI-Powered Gig Model is Threatening Healthcare. So this is basically the Uber model of an asymmetry of power plus surveillance plus AI equals maximal exploitation of the workers. And what's happening, let me just read you the quote from this report. Gig nursing apps, this is to say, let me just stop here. Gig nursing apps is like, imagine if your nurse was like an Uber driver, not a full-time employee of the hospital or whatever, but someone who's a nurse who gets called up by an app that says you have a job now for the next 2-3 hours or next shift or whatever it is. And here's the rate we're going to pay you. Okay, this is the Roosevelt Institute. Gig nursing apps may determine pay by what the firm knows about how much a nurse was willing to accept for a previous assignment, and how often they bid for shifts, or, this is the kicker, how much credit card or other kinds of debt they might hold. So get this, if you are in a hospital or in some healthcare facility and the facility brings you a gig nurse, through no fault of the nurse's own, the nurse could be working for exploitation wages because of surveillance pricing of their wages. It could be that the firm that's running the surveillance pricing on the gig nursing app saw in their surveillance data that that nurse has a lot of credit card debt. Well, let's just pay this person a lot less because they're probably desperate for the cash. Now, let me ask you, friends, is that fair to the nurse? Of course not. And on the patient side, is that the best situation for you to be in where the nursing care you're getting is being paid exploitation wages? No, I mean, it's not good for the nurse. It's not good for the patient. The only group that benefits is the exploiter, the one that is running the surveillance pricing con, the one that controls the AI surveillance. And so this is the emerging crisis number one, emerging dystopia number one about money. I could say a lot more about other aspects of money, but in this case, what we're seeing is that the use of money either to purchase items or trips or rent hotel rooms or the use of money to pay workers is going to be imbued with maximal exploitation due to the ambient surveillance that pervades our society and our economy. It's unjust, it's unethical, and we will all suffer because of it. And with that, friends, I think it's time for me to just take a little breather before we get to emerging crisis number two. Okay, we are back for emerging dystopia number two. If you're just tuning in, by the way, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. We're going through three emerging dystopias, or crises, if you prefer. The first one was called Money, around surveillance pricing. The second one that I'm going to head into right now is called Water. If you want links to all the sources in today's show, go to the Tectonic playlist, tectonic.fm. and click the playlist link for the three emerging dystopias episode. Okay, here's a deal about water. There was a fascinating article in the New York Times, July 14, 2025, written by Eli Tan. And this headline is, "Their water taps ran dry when Meta built next door." Now, this headline refers to Meta. I always call it Facebook Meta on the show, so everybody knows. We're talking about Mark Zuckerberg's sludge empire. And this is the deal. There is a community in Newton County, Georgia, the U.S. state of Georgia, where Facebook Meta has installed this giant AI data center. This is one of these enormous building complexes, just full of computer servers that are drawing down power and, increasingly, water in just ungodly amounts in order to do what they do. Now, if you could wave a magic wand and say, well, it's pretty bad what Zuckerberg's toxic empire is doing, so we don't like it, but as long as they don't bug anybody in the community, you know, live and let live, maybe. I'm just trying to be charitable here, but that's, you can't even say that, because the existence of the data center is having daily and immediate impacts on the citizens in that county. As the headline said, their water taps ran dry. So here's an excerpt. After Facebook Meta broke ground on a $750 million data center on the edge of Newton County, Georgia, the water taps in Beverly and Jeff Morris's home went dry. The couple's house, which uses well water, is 1,000 feet from Facebook Meta's new data center. Months after construction began in 2018, the Morris's dishwasher, ice maker, washing machine, and toilet all stopped working, said Beverly Morris. Within a year, the water pressure had slowed to a trickle. Then soon, nothing came out of the bathroom and kitchen taps. Okay, so again, we're focusing on water here. I could do a whole other section on electricity and the power grid, but here we're just talking about water, just water, okay? And this New York Times link is really interesting, goes into a lot of detail, and you can find the link. That's a GIF link on the playlist if you'd like to read more. The Times story says, a data center like Meta's, that is to say Facebook Meta's, which was completed last year, typically guzzles around 500,000 gallons of water per day. I'll say it again. A data center like Facebook Meta's completed last year typically goes through 500,000 of gallons of water daily. New data centers will require millions. That's multiple millions of gallons of water per day. And so this, friends, this is why people's taps are going dry in the proximal area of an AI data center like Facebook Meta's, because it is sucking down all the water in the county. Multiple millions of gallons per day. And so for a house like the Morris's that runs on well water, well, that's the water supply, and it needs to go to Facebook. And so their taps have run dry, and their toilets don't work, and so on. The Times article continues that this is a problem throughout the region. So I'm going to quote Times. Morris's experience is one of a growing number of water-related issues in Newton County. This is about 90 minutes east of Atlanta. As tech giants like Facebook Meta build data centers in the area, local wells have been damaged. The cost, this is interesting, the cost to citizens of municipal water has soared, and the county's water commission may face a shortage of the vital resource. The situation has become so dire that Newton County is on track to be in a water deficit by 2030. And this is the sad, grim, and rather shocking punchline to the entire Times story, and in fact to this emerging dystopia number two. Here's the sentence. If the local water authority cannot upgrade its facilities, residents could be forced to ration water. And that means, friends, that some communities, possibly many communities in the U.S. and around the world, near these big tech data centers, may have to start rationing water for citizens in order for Mark Zuckerberg's slop factory to create more toxic sludge to inject into the internet. Does that seem like a good exchange for you, that citizens living their lives should be deprived of their water in order that the richest people in the world can continue to unethically make their money by blowing out their slop on all the rest of us? I don't think that's a good exchange. As I said before with surveillance pricing, it's unjust. It's unethical. It's absolutely wrong. And we should be fighting against this. And I think there are pockets of resistance. But tell you, friends, I am sorry if you live anywhere near a big tech AI data center. And if you don't today, this is the other problem. It's probably coming for you at some point. Mark Zuckerberg posted on social media recently, I saw a screenshot of this. I do not use any of his properties. I don't use Facebook or Instagram or WhatsApp. And I recommend people delete their accounts with all three if they can. But I saw a screenshot of his recent social media post where he was bragging about the plans for a new hyperscale AI slop data center. He didn't call it that, but that's what it is, in which he overlaid the footprint of this building complex over, and I'm not making this up, over the map of Manhattan, the island where I live. And the footprint of this slop factory took up a giant swath of Manhattan, of the island of Manhattan. I don't know the percentage is 40%, 50%. It was a enormous, I mean, it's unthinkably big. And basically, this would-be emperor, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has always had this weird fascination with tyrannical Roman emperors. This would-be emperor is boasting, you know, the data centers that I have that are sucking down millions of gallons of water a day, ha, get this, my new slot factory is going to rival the size of Manhattan itself. I mean, what blind arrogance, what absolute hubris it takes to post something like that while citizens are suffering and while your plans are on the board to make even more citizens suffer by depriving them of water. Now, there's one more thing I want to say about water, and that is I've mentioned on the show maybe once, I think I had a brief mention, maybe twice. There was this old interview I did with Guillaume Petron a couple of years ago. He wrote a book called The Dark Cloud. That was a really early indication that we were in for some suffering around the environmental impacts of big tech. So this has come up. The issue of water and data centers has come up a couple of times. And whatever it does, I was here from either one way or another, I hear from a booster. And the booster says, Mark, you have it all wrong because the water is recycled in the data center, which is not. But they say the water is recycled. So why don't you just drop all your complaints about water? Yes, they use power, but they don't use water. As soon as they fill up their reservoir or whatever, it just cycles around and around and no water is ever lost. So let me go ahead and put the booster's response to rest here. If you go to the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, I have a link by Mary Zhang from January 17, 2024. It's called Why Do Data Centers Use Water? And this is from a report that Zhang wrote called Data Center Water Usage, A Comprehensive Guide. And it is a comprehensive guide to water usage in AI data centers. And basically what this report says is that, yes, the water is recycled through in a way, but in order to remove the heat from all the servers, they got to put the water in a cooling tower. And when the water goes to the cooling tower so that the heat can come off of the water, a lot of the water evaporates. And so guess what happens when the water evaporates? They need to draw down municipal water supplies more to refill the water that was evaporated when they were cooling it off because it drew away the heat from the servers. It's a very basic concept. You cannot simply recycle the water when it is boiling hot going through all the room of all the servers creating all the AI slop. The heat has to go somewhere. So the heat goes out and the water evaporates. That's how human bodies work off the heat in our bodies. Our sweat comes out of our pores and it evaporates. You understand the cooling potential of evaporating water, right? Okay, so are we all clear now? Slop factory AI data centers guzzle water. I don't want to hear any more pushback from the boosters trying to educate me on how the water is recycled because you are wrong. I don't usually get this strident, but I'm getting a little tired of hearing from boosters with that cockamamie excuse. And so ends dystopia number two. Let's take a moment to breathe. Okay, we're back. We've got one more emerging dystopia to get to. Again, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. Let's go ahead and talk about truth. Just as a review, we're going over three emerging dystopias that I'm seeing in the world today. One is money, which is surveillance pricing. The second was water, which is to say these slop factory, big tech AI data centers from Mark Zuckerberg and others are drawing down water supplies from citizens and communities in order to feed the slop producing sludge factories. Terrible exchange. And it's likely to get much, much worse. So now we get to emerging dystopia number three. This one's called Truth. And this one, it's interesting. You know, I was thinking about these three emerging dystopias, money, water, and truth. And the thing is, these three are all three essential items for life. We need money in order to buy the necessities of life. We need water in order to have physical life. And we need truth in order to have any semblance of a society, democracy, what have you. And truth also is emerging as a growing crisis in that the AI engines, the AI slop factories, are doing weird things to our sources of truth. So let me start with another Times article. This one is by Bill Wazik from June 16, 2025. Interesting article. A couple of sections were a little bit boosterish, but there was some pushback in there, which was good. The headline is AI is poised to rewrite history literally. And so Wazik from the Times goes and talks to a popular historian, Stephen Johnson, about who is an employee of Google, about how he uses Google's AI tools in order to research his history books. Johnson has a job of boosting Google's AI products. I get that. But what is really interesting about rewriting history, as Wazik puts it, is that AI is doing things both to the historians who are doing the research and more broadly to anyone else who is using AI for any sort of intellectual activity. And again, if it starts with historians and writers, it then spreads, it gets normalized and spreads to the rest of us. So we should pay attention to these edge cases that it's getting started on. And as Wazik writes, there is, I confess, something seductive about the idea of letting AI read for me. That is to say, to read the sources to help do research. Wazik continues, it seems inevitable that historians and other nonfiction writers will turn to AI for assistance. But it also seems inevitable that this power to help search and synthesize historical texts will change the kinds of history books that are written. And so what Wazik is getting at is that the use of AI by itself changes the output from human writers, human researchers, historians, and other people doing research and writing, could be students, anybody. It changes the output because we're using these tools. And that's not the only output. AI also, in recent studies, has been shown to cause cognitive decline, de-skilling, even psychosis in some cases, if people are relating too much to these personality chatbots. Not to mention the constant threat of erroneous information that gets spat out by these things, the so-called hallucinations. So with all of these risks of changing the output and changing the minds and the psyches of the people using these AI engines, the question is it even worth it to use them for, let's say, writing history books in the first place? And I appreciated that Wazik talked to Stacy Schiff. Quote, when I asked Stacy Schiff, the author of Decorated Biographies of Cleopatra and Vera Nabokov, about the notion of consulting AI on how to structure a piece of writing, she replied, to turn to AI for structure seems less like a cheat than a deprivation, like enlisting someone to eat your hot fudge sundae for you. I liked that depiction of using AI as depriving yourself of the real fun. After all, what is research? What is writing? But structuring your own thinking, structuring your own book. Why would you unilaterally? Why would you intentionally de-skill yourself, abdicating your role as a thinker and a writer to a machine in order to generate some mediocre structure, some mediocre thinking that didn't come from you? I like what Schiff is saying here. So one of the main crises in the emergence of AI, one of the crises of truth, is that the books that we read in the future increasingly are going to be infected by the AI engines. They could have errors. They could have been structured by the AI. They could be drawing on biases that are in the AI training set. You don't know. You don't know. And possibly the historian or the author, him or herself, doesn't know either. So that's a crisis of truth when we are sending our scholarly work, our writing, through an AI mediator in order to tell us what the truth is. You see where this leads to a world where books and articles and other sources of truth have all been run through the big tech AI engines for their version of the truth, not ours. That's incredibly dangerous for us to normalize this in the process of research and writing. And there's another aspect here as well, and that is, what are those primary sources that we're drawing on in order to do our research? In many cases, if we're getting them from the AI can only reach towards sources that are digital. Of course, the AI cannot reach into dusty physical archives that have not been ingested. So the AI is only accessing digital sources. And if I was writing a dystopia about the crisis of truth in 5 or 10 years, here's what I would do, friends. It would reach beyond the de-skilling and the psychosis and everything that LLMs have been documented to cause. It would go towards what happens to those primary sources themselves that are digital. Because at some point, friends, there's going to be an AI that modifies the source material to the benefit of the big tech owners. And that's when all bets are off. If you can think of any source material, any source of truth that is important to you, it could be an important document, it could be a sacred text, it could be a very important documentation of history book, or an article that you find very important. Any of those that are digital could, in the future, be quietly modified in ways that are hard to initially detect by an AI. And I know I'm going way out on a limb here. This is not documented yet in terms of history books, but there are some past examples of similar things happening. I looked around and there's this company called Riff. I'm going to give you this unusual example. RYFF. This is an article from .LA from May 1st, 2021. LA-based Riff uses video game technology for tailored product placement in film and TV. So the basic idea is there's this company, and it's not the only one. I'm just using Riff as an example. There are others. What they do is they use AI to go into old TV shows and movies and to put product placement retroactively into those shows and films. Basically, if you're watching an old movie and perhaps the person lifted a beer bottle, then if there was an advertiser, a beer company is advertising, they could ask this company, Riff, to use their AI to go back and modify the old movie in order to show the proper brand that's being advertised. So we've seen product placement in Hollywood movies. They do that all the time. Oh, are you driving a Mercedes? How interesting. You know, they'll put it in the script, or companies will pay a lot of money in order to get their product placed or spoken about in the movie or the TV show. This is different. This is going back and modifying the original source material. How do you feel about that? Well, you could say, well, it's just a cheesy TV show or movie. What's the big deal if someone drinks a, you know, whatever brand of beer in an old TV show? What is the big deal, in fact? Well, it goes beyond that because, and this is, again, from 2021. I'm going to read an excerpt. Riff helped Coca-Cola insert images of Coke bottles into classic footage from past sports tournaments, like UCLA's 2006, I believe this was basketball, finals run and North Carolina State's improbable championship in 1983. So here we're going into what I would have thought would have been the official record of these basketball championships. And you've got a company that's going back and, again, retroactively changing the footage using AI in order to display a product that is beneficial to whoever are the owners or the advertisers controlling this. Once again, you could say, that doesn't bother me. I don't watch the 1983 North Carolina State Championship. But listen to what I'm telling you. It starts in these edge cases and it spreads. If AI is used to modify the source material of these old TV shows, old movies, and old newsworthy events of, let's say, sports championships, where does it go from there? At some point, it gets to, I can almost guarantee you, it gets to the primary sources that are being ingested by the AI engines themselves. Because it's all digital, and it's all fungible in the minds of these tech bros. And if they can change something in order to make things more profitable, more advantageous to the companies, they will. And with their deep partnerships with various governments around the world, if you can just imagine, again, let's just entertain a flight of fancy. If you can imagine that there was ever an authoritarian government in the United States, that they may reach out to these companies and say, we need to modify some source materials of history that we find objectionable, and the tech companies say, yes, sir, right away. Who's going to know the difference? Well, you might, because you're old enough to remember history books before, maybe you lived through some of this history before the source materials were changed. The question is, what happens to the next generation? The next generation is being brought up in a digital age, run and dominated by these big tech companies that have full ownership and full control of these AI engines that are sucking down all of our water and are completely manipulating all of the money in the pricing and the wages. Do you think they'll stop there? Do you think they won't, if it's within their power, to take an order from an authoritarian to change primary sources to modify historical documents, so that when historians in the future come and say, tell me about the racist history of the US, tell me about the genocide of the Native Americans, tell me about something else that some people may find objectionable in the US's history. Oh, strangely enough, the AI can't find it. Can't find it. You may look into here's a link to the sources we used, and you look there. Strangely enough, it's not there anymore. It's all digital, all controlled by the big tech companies at that point. This is a crisis of truth. And I don't have a great suggestion for you, friends, except that print books are your friend for right now. And I received recently a very interesting letter in the mail, a postal mail, and I want to say thanks to listener Norm from New York City for sending me this. And there's a lot to say about what Norm wrote, but I just want to read something. Norm included in his letter to me an excerpt from an interview with American novelist Philip Roth. He wrote The Human Stain and many other novels. Actually lived on the Upper West Side, which is where I live. This is what this is what Philip Roth said in this interview. Roth said, every year 70 readers die and only 2 are replaced. That's a very easy way to visualize it. By readers, Roth said, he means people who read serious books seriously and consistently. The evidence is, quote, everywhere that the literary era has come to an end. The evidence is the culture. The evidence is the society. The evidence is the screen, the progression from the movie screen to the television screen to the computer. There's only so much time, so much room, and there are only so many habits of mind that can determine how people use the free time they have. Literature takes a habit of mind that has disappeared. It requires silence, some form of isolation and sustained concentration in the presence of an enigmatic thing. It is difficult to come to grips with a mature, intelligent, adult novel. It is difficult to know what to make of literature. That's why I say stupid things are said about it, because unless people are well-trained, they don't know quite what to make of it. And that was Philip Roth. Thanks to listener Norm for sending that along. And Roth, of course, as a literary novelist, had a reason to advocate for books, but he is absolutely right that it is increasingly important for us to develop the discipline of sitting in silence with a print book in order to develop our own thinking, to engage with a text. And it's even more urgent as we're facing these three emerging crises of money, water, and maybe especially truth, that we get our hands on these print books now, before they're taken over and modified and fully digitized and served back up to us in this gross sludge from an AI engine, asking us to think of truth in the way that the big tech companies want us to. It's important for us to grab these print books now. Go to your public library. Go to your independent bookstore. Find a print book that engages you. It could be a literary novel. It could be a history book. Something that you think is worthy of your attention. And read. Read, friends. That's our chance. Read. And that is about all the time I have for you. I hope you have found this somewhat enlightening, and I hope you have found it somewhat disturbing, as I do. The world that we are in is facing many more than three emerging crises, but we certainly, friends, we certainly are going to have to deal with these three. And I thank you, friends, for being with me on this journey. Let's take care of each other. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who you can't handle, who's going to be along with his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. And next time, I'm hoping to have live in studio a literary novelist who's been on the show a number of times in the past, my friend Ed Park, Pulitzer Prize finalist for his outstanding novel, Same Bed, Different Dreams. He's got a new book out, which we're going to talk about next time, if all goes to plan. In the meantime, friends, I have some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And for a closing song today, I've got a very important message for you. It's going to be hard to miss. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time.
Read a book that you won't believe. Read a book. Reading never dies. When you open your eyes, and then you'll see.
the shoulders, what else you gonna do with it? Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe watch videos, World Star, YouTube, Instagram, who knows?
I know, and I know that knowledge is powerful, and if you got it, you can do anything that you want.
Who are you? The positive coach, the reading coach, because you really doing the most. If you ain't talking about money, you ain't talking about nothing, because me and my I ain't worried about nothing.
Fidget, please, that's how you want to live your life, your whole life, not knowing how to read and write. What if you got jammed up but don't know your right, don't know how to read? You still got to pay the price.
Wait, what? I do?
Uh-huh. Why you looking real clueless? Don't get mad at me when your friends are calling you stupid.
I guess they really not my friends if they look down on me then.
Nope.
Would it really hurt if I do some reading?
Nope, it won't hurt, not at all. As long as you try this all and give your all. When you just
read a book,
you can really gain some knowledge. When you
read a book,
you can stimulate your mind. When you
read a book,
you might as well go ahead and just
read a book.
I can really get some knowledge when I
read a book.
I can stimulate my mind when I
read a book.
Even with my friends, I could
read a book.
Oh man, might as well just
read a book. Read a book. Read a book. Read a book. Read a book.
And they're off. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at this time. That is 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for joining me. Lots of great music this evening, as usual. And we're going to start tonight's show with a track from a group called Abstract Concrete. And oddly enough, this is a band that I don't want to make any assumptions about the managerial structure of the band, but it's a band that includes Charles Hayward, who, a name many of you will know. He was the drummer in This Heat, many, many other groups, Camberwell Now, really top notch drummer. And I, oddly enough, the record I'm going to play was released a couple years ago, 2023, and I only just found out about the existence of this band recently. Where have I been? I don't know why I just wasn't aware of them till recently. Anyway, I'm glad I've discovered them. We're going to hear a track from a self-titled record released again in 2023. Abstract Concrete is the band, and the music varies, and a lot of it is fairly straight ahead song stuff, which I don't mean as an insult. I mean it's not particularly proggy or prog adjacent E, but this track is. We're going to hear a piece called Ventriloquist Dummy from the group Abstract Concrete.
I'm not moving my mouth. I am the ventriloquist. Got this whole routine nailed
Music there from the group Abstract Concrete with some pretty wild time signature changes and trickery that I will resist the incredibly powerful temptation to describe to you in mathematical detail, but trust me, or just, you know, I'll leave it as an exercise for the listener. Go back, listen to it, and hear all the strange things they do with the rhythm. Drums, of course, by Charles Hayward, and also the always immediately recognizable voice of Charles Hayward on that track. Again, Abstract Concrete. The track we heard was Ventriloquist / Dummy from a self-titled record that's available on Bandcamp. I try to mention that whenever possible because you should patronize Bandcamp and buy music there if you can. We are going to hear music from Germany now. This is going to be a group called Alcatraz, and this is a track from a release from a record recorded in 1978 originally and released in